Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group. I'm joined by Omar Eltaray, our Senior Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, it's great to be with you as always. What are we talking about today?
So as we work our way through the final quarter of 2025, we wanted to take stock of the most recent completed quarter, so that's Q3, to really set the stage for the end of the year. With nearly all the data providers, REIT, and company earnings out covering Q3, we wanted to put a bow on the quarter and see what the end of the year is looking like. First, we'll take a quick look at the macro and market environment before we dive into the CRE trends and some of the key findings from our latest Q3 investment and transactions quarterly report covering the same period. So starting off with the macro and broader market environment in the U.S., the third quarter was defined by a powerful melt-up across risk assets as investors aggressively priced in a soft landing scenario. This optimism was really ignited by the Federal Reserve's first interest rate cut of the year in September, which came against a backdrop of a clearly cooling but not collapsing labor market and signs of further moderating inflation. Equity markets were led by the familiar kind of mega cap tech names, and they helped push the equity markets to all-time highs. And what was also crucial is that the rally broadened significantly following the Fed's cut, with small caps posting their best quarter since late 2023. In credit, the high-level theme is that there was buoyant sentiment and a reach for yield, which ultimately compressed spreads near historic lows and really fueled a blowout quarter for overall corporate bond issuance. Now, if we dive in even deeper on the macro front, the macroeconomic narrative shifted decisively towards disinflation and a slowing but resilient growth picture. The Fed's FOMC continued its easing monetary policy with the first cut in 2025 being in September, and that was a 25 basis point cut. The FOMC remained focused on kind of the softening labor market signals that they were getting. Meanwhile, they were also seeing progress made on the inflation front, but that was a bit complicated by the trade talks and tariff situation, which ultimately did raise some questions about additional cuts throughout the end of the year. Overall, economic growth moderated from a very strong Q2, but there were still signs that there was above trend growth, whether you were looking at the Atlanta Fed's GDP Now model, as well as economists and investors' consensus forecasts still showing pretty steady growth trajectory for the broad U.S. economy. Disinflationary trends continued through Q3, and the labor market did exhibit some signs of cooling, which ultimately provided cover for the Fed to continue easing. But during the third quarter, you also started to see economists and investors a bit more concerned around, that cooling in the labor market turning into actual contraction. We did see the unemployment rate tick up before the government data effectively was cut off. And so we ended the quarter with 4.3% unemployment rate. Turning attention to credit markets operated in a really risk-on environment through Q3. This was characterized by tightening spreads and heavy issuance. The benchmark 10-year U.S. Treasury yield declined approximately 8 basis points over the quarter, ending around 4.16%. The move was really driven by the Fed's dovish pivot and slowing growth expectations, though the yield curve remained inverted. Spreads compressed aggressively as investor demand surged. You can look at the Bloomberg U.S. Corporate High Yield Index, which saw the option-adjusted spread tightened by 23 basis points to finish the quarter approximately at 267 basis points. You also saw similar contraction in corporate credit across investment-grade spreads, which also tightened and ended near decade lows. This altogether really reflected kind of minimal investor fear of widespread defaults, and also the favorable backdrop of rates coming down, default rates still pretty stable. Ultimately, this led to big issuance, bond issuance numbers for the quarter. The high yield market in particular saw a blowout quarter with issuers raising over $124 billion in the quarter alone. And this is driven by them, essentially these companies and issuers locking in lower financing costs amid the strong market demand. If we turn attention to the equities market for Q3, we can see that equities posted exceptionally strong returns as the Fed cut and AI enthusiasm was really in full bloom. Major indices hit new records. The S&P gained 8.1%. NASDAQ was up closer to 10%. And what was quite notable during the third quarter was that the gains were pretty broad-based as the Russell 2000, so you can see this as really the smaller cap companies surging a pretty stellar 12%. If you look at valuations, the forward PE ratio for the S&P 500 was pretty elevated at 23 times. This is a pretty significant premium over whether you look at the 5-year or 10-year averages. But this was being driven by these rather robust tech company valuations, which also led to increasing concentration across the broad equity market indices. The top 10 names in the S&P 500 accounted for nearly 40% of the index's total market cap. That said, there were also, and outside the S&P 500, there were some notable pickup, or there was some notable pickup in M&A and IPOs. So the IPOs through the end of Q3 were outpacing the same period in 24. So that was a good sign of thawing or just more life and deal activity in the equity space. Now, while consumer and business sentiment were still pretty low throughout the quarter, and they were fluctuating quite a bit as consumers and business leaders were still uncertain around trade talks, inflation, the broader kind of macro environment. And towards the end of Q3, there was more attention paid to the government shutdown, which kicked in October 1st. The market sentiment seen across investors was actually still quite high through the third quarter. Volatility was suppressed, and analysts, while there was becoming more division around what 26 would look like, we're still quite comfortable with 2025 and the more near-term outlook. The VIX ultimately, which is a fear gauge or a measure of volatility within the market, was pretty muted throughout the quarter and was around average level of 16, which is kind of a historically low level. And a lot of this is showing this kind of soft landing narrative really coming into play and capital being a little bit more risk on. So a lot happened in the third quarter. But with that backdrop, Cole, how did the U.S. CRE investment and transaction market look through Q3?
Yeah, well, there's really no way around it. This was a very big growth quarter for CRE investment. So looking through Q3 25, about 46,000 properties transacted, and that's across single assets and portfolio or multi-property transactions. And that was up 12.6% from the prior quarter, so Q2 25, and up 6.8% from the prior year. And folks who paid attention to this report that we've put out for quite some time now know that we actually haven't seen annual growth in the number of properties transacted in quite some time. So this is a pretty big figure.
I wouldn't say, though, that it was even across sectors. You saw hospitality transactions down 11.9% annually. Office sales were actually up 14.6% annually, which I think came as a shock to me. But now, if you're looking at dollars transacted, aggregate transaction volume reached around $150 billion in the third quarter. That was up 23.7% from quarter two and up 25.1% from the same period a year prior. And if you were just to dig into the individual sectors there, you could attribute a lot of that growth to multifamily. That surged 51.1% on the year and accounted for around 30% of all activity. So single asset multifamily sales, just to hammer this point home, accounted for almost a third of all activity, even including portfolio transactions. And then if you were to remove portfolio transactions, it was more than a third of all single asset dollars. So pretty incredible. Industrial was up 26.5% on the year in terms of dollars spent. Office up 28%. General commercial properties, which is a bit of this catch-all category for us, up 48.9%. And then again, multifamily up 51.1%. So those were the sectors that had year-over-year spending gains that outpaced the overall gain of 25.1%. And again, in other words, that annual increase appears to really have been driven by a lot of the multifamily sector. So some pretty big figures there.
Yeah, those are some rather solid headline numbers in terms of transaction activity in CRE, and really seem to reflect that kind of broader risk-on appetite that, you know, I was talking about with the broader capital markets. But Cole, let's dive a little bit deeper into the pricing and pacing trends. What were you seeing there?
I know we're about to dig through a lot of what's within this report, and there's a ton of numbers. So I think maybe first we give an overview of what we're looking at here so folks understand where we get this data and how it gets compiled into the report. So this is from the Investment in Transactions Quarterly. It's based on Altus's Reonomy data set. It's a blend of public and private property data sources. But what we're covering here is single and multi-property transactions in the third quarter. So we pulled this on October 15th, and it captures deals through September 30th. But this is closed, recorded, non-distress sales located within the U.S. metropolitan area, both single asset and multi-asset transactions. So above $100,000 for individual properties, above $300,000 for multi-property. And these are the stats that you're about to hear that you just asked me about will mostly refer to property count and dollar volume. And most of the pricing measures will be on a per square foot basis. Most of these will be medians, but those stats will specifically refer to single property transactions. With that in mind, the pricing stats are something I want to get into here. Median price per square foot for single property transactions rose 2.9% on the quarter in the third quarter. There were two sectors that actually outpaced the overall figure. That was office, up 4.3%, and multifamily, up 3.5%. Now, on an annual basis, median pricing really grew, 14.2% across all properties that we looked at. The strongest gains, though, were in multifamily, up 17.3%, and in office, up 14.8%. General commercial was up 13.8%. Now, looking at pacing, we had a fairly slow start to this year. For folks who have paid attention to our recaps of this report on the podcast, there weren't super great figures in the first and the second quarter, but transaction activity really rebounded in the third quarter. So of known single property sales, so this is sales that we have in the Reonomy database, no scaling metrics have been applied here. So far, through the first three quarters of 2025, about 93,000 single property sales. And that was between the year-to-date tallies we saw in 2013, which is 86,000, and 2015, which was 97,000. So we're right in there with 2014's figure. But the cumulative dollar volume of single property transactions was $265 billion. And again, even before applying any scaling metrics to this, we have already outpaced the same period in either 2023 or 2024. So I think that's an incredibly strong sign for the market here.
Okay, so Q3 was a strong quarter in terms of U.S. CRE transaction activity, in terms of both counts as well as total dollar volume transacted. And on top of that, the median pricing was generally also on the rise. Some rather notable increases in certain sectors like multifamily and office. Let's dive a little bit more into kind of those sector trends and subsector trends. What were you seeing through Q3?
Yeah, and just to tell folks again, one of the things I think makes this report really great is that we're able to dig into these subsector trends. The retail sector is not just shopping malls. It's all kinds of other stuff, including automotive, bars and restaurants, individual anchor stores. And so we're able to collect all that through the Reonomy database. And I think it's incredible that we can even glean some pricing trends here. So we track 15 subsectors, and 13 of those 15 recorded a quarterly increase in median price per square foot in the third quarter. Some of the strongest ones, storage, up 7.6%, full service hotels, up 5.2%, automotive, up 5%. Only bars and restaurants and big box stores were down on the quarter. So restaurants down 2.4%. Big box down 2.8%. Thought it was interesting that the only two subsectors did fall within the broader category of retail. On an annual basis, all 15 subsectors saw price gains. Strongest was automotive, up 19.4%. Other industrial, which is often a lot of warehouse properties, was up 18.1%. Now, slowest growth, on the other hand, even though everything was positive, hospitality took the crown for both of these. Limited service hotels up 3.9% on the year, full service hotels up 3.4% on the year. So barely outrunning general inflation there. Now, something else we look at, and this is another pacing metric, not looking at it year to date, but just the average number of properties that would transact on a given day throughout the quarter. In Q3 2025, it was up above pandemic era lows, but it is still below the average that you would see for the number of properties that would trade on a typical day in 2015 to 2019 across virtually every sector. So just to give an example of this, on a typical day, 2.1% fewer office properties traded in the third quarter 2025 than did in that 2015 to 2019 period on a given day, and 12.9% fewer multifamily properties traded. This is really fascinating to me because volumes in some of these sectors are actually up, but the number of properties trading on a given day is way down. So we're actually seeing much larger properties trade. Now, this might be a little more convoluted to understand, but the typical size of a transacted building is something we take a look at too by sector. It was largely unchanged for all sectors quarter on quarter, but you have seen the typical building size or the typical size of a transacted building increase on the year. Office up 3.6%, multifamily up 4.1%, hospitality up 9.9%. That one's fairly volatile, but those are already fairly large properties. Now, if you're looking at the value of an individual deal, you were looking at double-digit increases across all sectors on an annual basis, but there were huge increases for multifamily, up 27.3%. It's actually something we recognized in the second quarter as well. The median office deal, its size increased by about 24%. And so that, I think, is helping drive a lot of the strong annual gains in sector level volume for those two in particular.
Okay, so that makes sense. And if you bring some of those metrics together, if the typical size of properties that are transacting was muted or didn't really change much, but you did also see these kind of big price per square foot. So if the square footage isn't necessarily changing much, but you see the price per square foot actually changing substantially, that actually then leads to that other metric, which is the kind of median value of the deals really growing, because it's all kind of like price driven.
Well, and it was fairly muted on a quarterly basis, but on an annual basis, these are, you're talking many factors larger for a typical deal size here. It's pretty big.
Yeah. Okay. That intuitively makes sense. Or yeah, I guess that kind of mental math, whatever. Let's shift focus to kind of the geographic differences. What were you seeing in terms of changes across different markets?
Yeah, and I regret that I'm delivering what would be best shown in a visual format, in audio format, but I will direct folks to the report later in the recording here. But volume-wise, on a quarterly basis, in terms of the number of properties that transacted, which was up 12.6%, like I mentioned before, every single MSA in the Northeast, or the Acela corridor for those who are frequent Amtrak users, so from DC to Boston, with the sole exception of the Providence MSA, underperformed the broader country in terms of the change on the quarter. Most California metros also underperformed the broader country in terms of the number of properties that transacted or the change on the quarter. But on the opposite end, most MSAs in the South did much better than the country did. Only a few did not exceed the national change. Jackson, Mississippi, Knoxville, Charleston, Orlando. What is really unique about this report that we have not seen, or at least I don't remember seeing in any previous report that we've done, is that almost every Texas metro saw increases that exceeded the national change. And in this case, it was by 20 percentage points or more for most of those. I've actually heard anecdotally from some other transaction reports that Dallas and Houston, a few other of the big metros, had huge quarters. Our data seems to be reflecting that as well. Now, there wasn't a super clear geographic trend when you break this out by the change in dollar volume, but I did notice that the California MSAs lagged the broader country again in this metric in a pretty big way. And so did many of the landlocked MSAs east of the Mississippi. Not really sure what to make of that yet, but I'll have to maybe have to dig into some individual deals that happened in some of those smaller metros. Now, that was quarterly. Taking a look annually, in terms of the number of properties transacted, the Northeast, Midwest, and most of the non-coastal Southeast were laggards. The broader country was up around 6.8%, but most metros in those regions actually underperformed the broader country. Out west, Pacific Northwest, some of the California metros on an annual basis actually showed some strong growth that exceeded that 6.8%. Now, in terms of the total value of properties transacted, which is up around 25% nationally, there was some major dispersion by MSAs. MSAs in Texas, Florida, and the Carolinas saw huge surges that outpaced the rest of the country. But large MSAs in the Midwest, Northeast, and Southern California lagged pretty significantly. Now, if we shift focus to pricing trends, which is also a component of this report, and we break these out by property type and by MSA, at least for the top 10, across the 10 largest MSAs, median price per square foot rose across nearly all major property sectors. And I apologize, I'm about to slice this in a number of different ways, but Los Angeles was the clear outlier in these metrics. Declines across every major property sector. Median price per square foot down 27.3% for office, 21.5% for retail, and nearly flat for industrial, but down slightly, 0.6%, and then multifamily down 0.4%. Now, the largest price gain among property type and MSA combos was Miami office, the typical trade on a per square foot basis, price up around 33%. The largest decline was almost opposite that in Washington, D.C., with multifamily trades, the median price per square foot down 30.4%. So it was a huge drop. Now, New York, Chicago, Dallas, Miami, and Atlanta, so half of those 10 metros, saw annual increases in median price per square foot across all major property types. Chicago was actually the closest to seeing double-digit growth in every sector. Retail was up only 6.8% on the year. Washington had the widest dispersion. So you remember that 30.4% figure for multifamily down, but office actually up 22.5%. I wonder if that's a little kind of flight to quality metric. It's only the highest quality stuff trading in this kind of post-Doge and leading into the government shutdown world here. And then lastly, multifamily was the only sector that had at least three of the top 10 MSAs showing declines on a per square foot basis. So LA, DC, and Phoenix, but a lot of interesting stuff to unpack there.
A lot of numbers. I know that you've been living in the data for the last couple of weeks, at least.
And yeah, there are some folks on this call that would not be envious of the number of SQL queries that are up on my screen at any given time, but I love putting this report together.
Just be impressed, too. Yeah. So all of this and more will be available in the Q3 Investment and Transaction Quarterly Report. However, Cole, before we sign off, because you have been so deep in the data, dissecting it, slicing and dicing it, was there anything that jumped out and like really surprised you this quarter?
Yeah. And look, I want to make it clear too that this report is meant to be very like light on commentary, very heavy on data and visuals. I know that you and I helped put together a kind of summary of what happened in the quarter. That's more or less what we wanted to do on this podcast episode as well. But there's clearly some stuff that stood out that I want to talk about now that wouldn't show up in the report commentary itself. The biggest thing for me here, it is really hard to notice where you are in the moment, but I think we can go back and look with a few extra quarters worth of data and really see where the CRE turnaround began to happen. So going back to some of those pricing trends, median price per square foot declined across most property sectors following rate hikes in 2022. The only real exception was in a few sectors that I think were booming despite rate hikes. And notably industrial, which saw median pricing flat for many quarters. But gradually, prices began to recover throughout 2024. And you've seen them actually start to accelerate or turn up in 2025. They've really taken off. Now, a metric that's a little harder to grasp, but is still telling from my perspective, is that transacted building size. If you look back over the last 10 years of single property deals, you will notice some major cyclicality in this figure in when physically large properties tend to transact that would be driving up that figure. Across most property types, the median size of a transacted property skyrocketed following the pandemic and then plunged, in some cases, lower than the pre-pandemic figure after rate hikes began. But something really interesting has become clear to me, and that's that the tide has turned again. Median transacted building size bottomed out in early 2024, Q1 for retail and hospitality, Q2 for multifamily and industrial, and then Q4 for office. It has steadily been climbing every quarter since for each sector. Put those two together, and you mentioned this before, increasing price per square foot, increasing property size, and you get a median deal size that has really jumped by large factors for a lot of these sectors. Deal sizes peaked during the post-COVID boom in a lot of these sectors, but now we've met or even exceeded them in Q3 2025. That's the case for every sector except for multifamily, which I suspect only needs another quarter or so to exceed its kind of boom period, a typical deal size. So that brings me to another point. Q3 2025 appears to be the quarter when large deals that I'm defining here as $10 million and above came back in a really big way. In just the first 2 months of the third quarter, we already surpassed the number of single property deals over $10 million that we saw in all of Q2. So by our estimate, the total number of these deals is the highest we've seen in any quarter since 2022. But there is a crucial difference. The median deal size among that group, $10 million and above, is quite a bit smaller, around $2 million smaller, which does help explain why total dollar volume is still well below those 2021, 2022 levels. But don't let that distract you from the bigger picture here. This was just simply a strong quarter compared to others in the post-rate hike period. My suspicion is that some of this can be attributed to one of two things. We did actually get a rate cut during this quarter. And I think a lot of decision makers held off in making decisions in Q2 following Liberation Day, which kicked off the quarter, and made up for it in Q3. Typically, Q3 deal activity is pretty similar when compared with Q2 in both number and dollar volume. When we took a look at our data, this was the case over the last really 25 years. But something about Q3 2025 seems really different. All right, let's bring this all together. The return to large deals cannot be overlooked. That has been a big question of mine for a long time. When would these come back? And I think that return is helping pull quarterly and annual dollar volume changes back into positive territory, which we've been looking for some time. That said, there's still major divergence playing out by sector. You're talking about a 50% increase for multifamily, but a barely 20-something percent increase for office. There's still a lot to unpack here. This is something that was talked about in many 2025 outlooks and in a lot of REIT earnings calls, but it's definitely visible in the report data. So folks are welcome to take a look into some of those. But really, I just can't wait to see what happens when we close out the year. I want to see how it all stacks up. All right. That was my kind of monologue there. But what about you? What did you see in this data? What was a big surprise?
Yeah, I'll build off of one of the points that you were speaking to, because I would say that the size of Q3 was really what surprised me. Seasonality is very real in U.S. CRE transaction and investment activity and the data that captures that. So typically in terms of the count, so just looking at the number of deals getting done within a quarter, as you mentioned, usually Q2, Q4 are the largest, while Q1 and 3 tend to be a bit smaller. Over the last 25 years, the number of deals completed in Q3 that has exceeded Q2 deal counts was only 28% of the time, or really 7 of those 25 years have you seen Q3 beat Q2. So generally speaking, usually Q2 is bigger than Q3. And if you look at the years in which Q3 was bigger than Q2, those were 2003, 2009, 2013, 14, 15, 2020, and 2021. Those were generally either coming out of a recession or were clearly recovery periods for commercial real estate. The kind of unseasonably strong Q3 that we just came out of, so Q3 2025, my interpretation of it is that it really is a confirmatory sign of recovery of the CRE markets. And outside of the post-pandemic Q3, this is really the largest Q3 jump from Q2 that we've seen over the last quarter century. Another sign of kind of improving momentum in CRE financing, which then drives transactions and ultimately pricing. There are multiple other signs that we've seen outside of this data that really show this kind of building momentum within the CRE financing transaction and pricing across CRE markets. Much of this kind of unseasonably strong Q3 was echoed in the recent CRE brokerage and REIT earnings calls, which we recapped on a prior CRE exchange episode. But one thing that makes me think that there actually is momentum here is we recently received the Fed's Senior Loan Officer Opinion Survey, which was released on November 3rd and showed that bank lenders are increasingly not tightening underwriting standards and are seeing more demand for CRE financing. All of this together really makes me think that we are headed towards a very robust end of year and very strong Q4. If we take one last kind of look at the historical example, 72% of the time over the last quarter century, Q4 has been larger than Q3. So generally, Q4 is larger than Q3. And if we already had this really robust Q3, this makes me think that we're about to close out the year on kind of a really high note. So I think it'll be exciting to see if this momentum actually is momentum and carries us to 2026. But to your point, it's hard to see where we are in the moment. And always hindsight is 2020. But that's what stuck out to me in this batch of data.
Well, it is funny for us to deliver some of these numbers in this medium because this is actually a very visual report. I mean, I know if you've been a listener for a long time, you know that we like to deliver not a lot of numbers, but there's a lot more in the full report for folks to check out. And we'll give a link in the show notes or it'll be available on the Altus website. But Omar, great talking with you today. I think that's all the time we have. But before we sign off, I just want to encourage our listeners once again, if you like the show, we'd love it if you could rate it. Give us 5 stars on Apple or Spotify. Leave us comments there as well. We'd love to read them. Or feel free to just send us an email at altusresearch@altusgroup.com. We'd love to know what topics you'd like covered on the program. In the meantime, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you on another episode of the CRE Exchange. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.